It's Diane. On my mind, the surge of the coronavirus across the country. The last few days have seen record-breaking numbers of new infections. Hospitalizations are up, and officials warn of tens of thousands of COVID deaths in the coming weeks. Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He's known as a straight talker when it comes to the threat posed by the virus. He says the U.S. is likely entering the darkest days of the pandemic. Earlier this week, Joe Biden appointed Dr. Osterholm to his COVID advisory board. He joined me to give us an idea of what he's telling the president-elect. Dr. Osterholm, if you would lay out the state of the pandemic for us right now, how bad are the numbers?
Well, unfortunately, we are really entering the darkest days of this pandemic. I think between now and next spring, when we are going to have vaccine available for a large part of the population, we will see, unfortunately, a lot of pain and suffering. Right now, you think about just where we've been. Even in just the last 2 months, the Tuesday after Labor Day, we were at 23,000 cases a day in this country. Today, we're reporting out 163,000 cases and over 1,100 deaths. In addition, at the rate of change that we're seeing here, it won't be long at all before we will be clearly well over 200,000 cases a day.
Wow. That's really extraordinary. Is it as you expected?
You know, it is in the sense that we knew that there would be a convergence of risk behaviors that would occur over time, and that the number of people susceptible was so large that when those two collided, we would see this. And in fact, in the first week of August, I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times predicting really where we're at right now. And what happened was, after the late summer months, we begin to see this real sense of pandemic fatigue kick in. These were people who believed that the pandemic was real. They had taken real efforts to reduce their risk, but they had just grew tired of the pandemic. And unfortunately, they grew tired of the virus before it grew tired of them. These were people who went back out to restaurants and bars. They started going to weddings and funerals again. They went to school-associated events. They were going to churches. They were back in public spaces. They were riding in cars together. They were going to neighborhood parties. And that was one element. The second element, though, was what really emerged in part due to the political nature of our country right now, and a group that I call those with pandemic anger. These are people who don't believe the pandemic's real. They think that, in fact, it was all made up for an election purpose, and that, therefore, any public health recommendations that they might be subjected to are meaningless. And so we had that group. And then the final ingredient of this kind of perfect storm was indoor air. We know that the virus concentrates much more indoors. It doesn't dissipate like it does outdoors. And, you know, we've seen this with all the respiratory pathogens. Once you're indoors more, the likelihood for transmission is just that much greater. When you put all three of those together, and the fact that we came into this fall with probably somewhere between 10 and 12% of our population having been previously infected. In other words, almost 90% were not. That's a lot of wood for this coronavirus forest fire to burn. And that's what's happening right now. And so this very rapid acceleration of cases shouldn't have been a surprise. It is one that is only going to get much, much higher. When you just look at the acceleration of cases right now, we're in what we call basically a rapid expansion of cases or geometric mean increase. And it's going to be one that I don't know where the top is going to be.
So you're saying we're already in the COVID hell, or we're about to get there?
We're in the COVID hell now. If you could spend just 20 minutes in an intensive care unit in any hospital in many different locations today, you would see what I'm talking about. We have so overstretched our hospital capacity that we have people who need immediate care, intensive care kinds of requirements that are sitting in waiting rooms for 10 to 12 hours to be seen. We have many, many locations right now where the staffing is so stretched that people who require intensive care doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists, they have a bed, but that's about it. And the challenges we have right now is that this is just beginning. When you look at the previous peaks that we had, Diane, if you look at the one in April, in particularly New York City, and the one in July, where it was Florida, Georgia, Texas, Arizona, and Southern California, we were able to borrow healthcare workers from other areas of the country that could come in and help out because the other parts weren't under such heavy attack from the virus. Today, everybody's under attack. And so there is no pool of healthcare workers to move from one location to another. And that has really compromised our capabilities. On top of it, we have a need for certain drugs to treat these patients with. I'm not talking about the drugs, kind of the blockbuster new experimental drugs for COVID-19, but the drugs, for example, just to paralyze you so that you can be intubated. You know, you can put a tube down your throat. There are 40 of these drugs that we've identified. Right now, 29 are in short supply. Almost all of them are coming from Asia. And this time, as opposed to the previous peaks when we needed these drugs, Europe was quiet. Right now, Europe's on fire, and they have a need for the same drugs. So they're pulling from the very same supply chains that we have. So it won't be long. We'll not only be short on personnel, but we're going to be very short on the critical drugs we need every day just to treat these patients.
And what about food? There has been talk of food shortages.
You know, I think it's one of those situations right now where we want to be very careful not to speculate in a way that in a sense scares people. But I've always said my job was not to scare people out of their wits, but into their wits. And I think that what we're going to be seeing in the next 2 months will be real challenges to a lot of our supply chains, like food, like other things that we need every day, because the number of infections will just grow and grow. Again, let me remind you, probably right now about 12%, maybe after the last week or two of activity, maybe as high as 14% of the U.S. population has been infected with this virus. That means a lot of people are still left to get infected. And if we don't change our ways, if we don't begin to listen to the public health messages, and we don't distance, we don't wear masks, we don't basically take account for our own protection, we're going to see these numbers climb astronomically, which will then threaten things like grocery stores.
You gave me a few reasons at the start that the virus has skyrocketed. Is another, a fourth reason, the imbalance of attention between the virus and the economy?
Yes. And, I find this a really unfortunate situation, and I'm glad you raised it. I think it's very important. Polling organizations asked voters when they left the voting booths on election day, was their vote influenced by the economy or COVID? As if somehow there's a dichotomy. There's not. They are absolutely intricately linked together. Right now, if you look at what's happening in our communities, a lot of small businesses are hanging on by a thread. Individuals who don't have work basically are just trying to keep a roof over their head. There's not been any support coming from Washington in recent months. And if we're going to ask these people to do more, we've got governors now closing down bars and restaurants, limiting other public events, and understandably so, they should be. But we don't have a means of helping these people who are going to be impacted by this. And I have argued, as well as in an op-ed piece that Neil Kashkari, the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, argued last August, we should be helping to support these people. And it turns out, Diane, that an interesting phenomenon has happened with regard to the pandemic. We have actually gone from about 8% of personal savings with income to over 22%, meaning people haven't spent their money. That money is now sitting in banks around the country waiting to be invested. And it turns out that with historic low interest rates, with this pool of money that we could pay ourselves back, not some foreign government or some foreign entity, and we could use that money as government stimulus to actually cover for these people we're asking to, take one for the team, stay home, don't be out. Small businesses, please close, but make sure you're going to be held whole here. Hospitals being covered, schools being covered, state, city, county governments being covered. And if we did that, I think we would see much more cooperation among those who would say, oh, you know what, I'll shelter in place for 4 or 5 weeks to drive this virus down, to get it to a level that we could control until we get to vaccines next year, early next year.
I think you're going to be on President-elect Biden's task force on the virus. Is that correct?
I am on this task force, yes.
What will you be recommending to him now?
You know, I will just give him my observations from, you know, on the front lines. You know, as somebody who has spent 25 years at a state health department, as a state epidemiologist, I still am very, very connected with health departments around the country. You know, I have talked to 4 governors just in the last day about what is going on and what can we do. And so I think my job is to best relay to him and the rest of his team just what I see happening and what I think can be done. And I plan on doing that. You know, it may not always be popular, but I know that the leadership wants to hear what do we know that's happening on the ground.
Do you believe a lockdown is going to be necessary and or feasible?
Well, first of all, let me just say at the outset, I hate the term lockdown. And part of it is if you interviewed 50 people, you could get 75 different answers as to what a lockdown is, I think. What we're really talking about is how do we limit transmission with social and physical distancing? How do we do that? And lockdown has become almost synonymous with masks in the sense that either you're for them or you're against them. It's about your freedom or it's about public health, whatever. What I have proposed, and I did in the op-ed piece with Neil Kashkari, was in fact, whatever we do, we have to compensate people for it so that they're not left behind. When people suffer, when I'm unemployed and I've got 2 kids I need to feed and I don't have a roof over my head if I don't pay my monthly rent, you know, why or how am I going to stay at home when I need to go out and find a job if I can? And so I think the challenge is that no one else is really proposing this. People are all saying, well, you know, the governors right now are making these recommendations and modifications. You know, right here in Minnesota, our governor just basically ordered bars and restaurants to close down at 10 o'clock at night and other things like that. And I think these are great things, but are they going to be enough? You know, and we have to stop saying, well, just give them the public health message of wash your hands and wear a mask. It's not working. And this rapidly escalating number of cases can best be understood if you spent 20 minutes in a hospital. I have heard from so many intensive care doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists said, please help us stop this out there. We can't handle this anymore. So, you know, I'm going to say that we've got to take more extreme measures.
Such as?
Well, I think, for example, stay-at-home orders. You know, the governor of Illinois last night just issued a recommended stay-at-home order. Now, again, that's in isolation of any other states. There's no coordination around that. I give him great credit for what he did. But then also these people then are going to lose potentially their apartments. They're going to lose their houses. They're not going to be able to feed their kids. And I think that's really it. Another thing that I'm so concerned about, Diane, when we have this high level of transmission, it's almost virtually impossible to open your schools. It's just really hard. And education is such an important part of our lives. We need to get the transmission levels down so that we can safely open schools. If you had to ask me, would I pick bars and restaurants over opening schools? No, I'll pick schools first. But then that means I'm willing to help support bars and restaurants so that they don't go out of business because of this. Then when we support schools, kids can go back. They can learn like they should. And more importantly, as the continuum of that is that now parents don't have to stay at home necessarily, or if they do, they can spend more time on their work from home because now they're not trying to serve as a second teacher for their children. And so I think one of the things that we can do is we can all agree on a lot of these things about what would be the best way to help each other. And that's what I've tried to focus on. How can we get people to change their behavior by helping each other?
What else are you going to recommend to President-elect Biden?
Well, I think right now, to me, one of the most important things that can be done is just the sense of leadership. I wish we had FDR moments right now where we had fireside chats, where somebody could tell us the story of where we're at, not judgmental, just this is it. This is not a good day, but this is what we're going to do to get out of it. And, you know, between now and early next year, when vaccines will become available, if we can just hold together that long, if we can reduce the number of cases and deaths just till we get to that, and that's going to take leadership. That's going to take somebody coming together. You know, I said last March, in fact, I mentioned it on your show, I said, you know what? We're not going to have red and blue states when this is over with. We're not going to have red and blue counties. It's going to be all COVID colored. And it's happened. And now what we need to do is bring people together. It's us versus the virus. It's not us versus us. It's not us versus you. You know, I just heard from a state organization in the hospitality industry that is considering trying to impeach their governor in that state because of measures he's been taking to try to limit transmission. And I shared with him, you know, the governor's not your enemy here. Do you really think with the high rate of transmission you have in your state right now that the hospitality industry is going to be wide open doing well? No. You know, the virus is your enemy. What we need to do is figure out how to reduce that so that the hospitality industry can come back and do what it does.
Tell me why it is that the actual death rate is going down, even though the number of cases is going up.
You know, I wish it would stay like that, but I'll tell you right now, that's an artificial situation. And what I mean by that is one of the great successes in this entire pandemic has been the information learned by the intensive care medicine teams, doctors, nurses, all of them, about how to better treat these patients.
Yes.
No blockbuster drugs, you know, just really better care. So we've seen the case fatality rate, or the percentage of people who are in intensive care who have died back in April, that's been reduced by over 60%. Some places almost 70% since then.
How come? I mean, is it a later use of the ventilator? What is it?
It's a combination of a number of things. First of all, how to put people on ventilators or not, how to keep them oxygenated. It's how to use steroids to reduce the inflammation that occurs, how to move patients, just simply moving them in the beds to basically make sure that you don't have certain setups in terms of your lungs position and so forth. It's just been incredible what they've done. They are our true heroes. They are the angels of this pandemic. But what's happening is, as I just mentioned at the beginning of the show here, we're running out of them. We don't have them anymore for a lot of the patients, these intensive care medicine people, because basically the numbers of cases are outstripping their care. So just because you have a bed doesn't mean you're getting the same quality of care. And what's going to happen here is that, and we're starting to see it now, is in the next weeks to months, the death rates are going to go back up again. And it's going to be because, you know what, you don't have the same level of care you had before. You know, I would just say if somebody was a hospitalist, a physician who works in the hospital, they do amazing things. They're incredibly well-trained, and thank God we have them. But if you and I were coming into the hospital right now with a major brain bleed, would you want the hospitalist doing your brain surgery? Would you want the neurosurgeon do your brain surgery? And what's happening in the intensive care medicine side, we're losing all of that ability to have these people by the sheer numbers of cases. So that's why the case fatality rate is going to go up. And then I would add that drug shortage piece I just mentioned is now going to compound that.
More of my conversation with Dr. Michael Osterholm when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Dr. Michael Osterholm. He is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Talk to me about this news we had from Pfizer this week about the effectiveness of their vaccine. How important do you think this is?
Well, I actually think it's very important. First of all, it demonstrates that we, in fact, can, make an immune response with the vaccine that would be protective of something in terms of the illness. And I think that's a very, very important first step. The questions we have, but we haven't seen the data for yet, are the issues around what does it mean to say it's 90% effective or efficacy? Is that 90% of preventing fever, cough, and chills? Is that 90% of preventing severe disease, hospitalization, and deaths, or where in between? For example, as we've talked on this very show before, with influenza vaccines, we know that the very people who have the highest risk of having a severe influenza illness are the same people who don't respond nearly as well to the vaccine. So, it doesn't necessarily prevent the infection, but if it can prevent hospitalization, that's great. Meaning that, so what we're going to have to find out yet with these vaccines is what is that level of protection mean? And we will learn that soon. The second thing I think is we still have to ask ourselves, how long do these vaccines last for? Meaning, what is the level of protection? Is it a couple of months? Remember, all these data at 2 months after the second shot. What is it like at 6 months, at 12 months, at 18 months? And we'll learn that. And we surely don't want to hold up on getting vaccines to people. I mean, we have over 1,100 people dying today of this virus. So we've got to get these vaccines out if we can show that they're safe and they're effective. And then we'll learn more about them as we go.
So will you be among the first to take that vaccine?
Well, let me put a caveat on that. I'd love to be the very first one. But you know what? There are people who are more needy of it than me. It's people who have underlying health problems. It's people who are older. It's people who have a need to be protected. So I will get in line when it's my turn. And I'll be right there. Trust you. I'll be there. I don't want to budge in front of line, but I don't want to be one person behind me, okay?
At the same time, what about those people who will be fearful of this vaccine?
You know what we haven't done, which is really very, very important, is we have not yet done anything to really convince the American public through education, through contact follow-up, why these vaccines are going to be important. I think Operation Warp Speed has been truly a Manhattan Project in its making in terms of helping to develop these vaccines. I think the process has been remarkable. The ability to manufacture these vaccines and get that set up has been remarkable. But what we haven't done very well yet is start to educate the public in advance of their arrival and say, this is why you want it. This is what we know about them. This is why we believe they're safe. This is why we believe they're effective. And this is a situation where we get those people who are known to the community, celebrities, athletes, doctors, people like you, people who people trust, and say, yes, get the vaccine. We need to start doing that now because we don't want to have to try to do that after the vaccine gets here.
And will it be free of charge?
Right now, every indication is that it's free of charge, and that's good.
I realize this is a little bit out of your bailiwick, but what do you make of the news that one of the key executives in Pfizer has sold a huge chunk of his Pfizer stock?
Yeah, I don't know enough to comment on that. I don't know if it was part of a planned sales, whatever. All I can say is that as a company, I appreciate that Pfizer's brought us this vaccine. They appear to have done it safely, and they've appeared to have done it with effective scientific data. And right now, I appreciate them for that. And, I'll let those who are experts in deciding ethics and finance, whether that was an appropriate sale. I just appreciate the company getting us this vaccine.
How long is it going to take the FDA to grant approval?
I wouldn't want to prejudge the FDA's activities. I will say the following, that, I've been following very closely and carefully what's gone on with the review of these vaccines at FDA. Initially, there was some concern that there may be political influence on when these vaccines would be approved. I am completely confident that, in fact, these vaccines will get approved just as they should scientifically. That, FDA has some of the very best regulatory science experts in the world that understand vaccines, how to measure them, and how effective and safe they are. And so I'm confident that between the FDA group and the outside experts they bring in to review them, that these are going to be as well-reviewed as any vaccine has ever been. So I'm confident that this is going to be a good thing. We need to get it out. But as you pointed out, we've got to start educating people now about how and why they want to get this vaccine.
But, you know, we've been trying to educate people for years and years about measles vaccine, about whooping cough vaccine. And yet there is a certain part of the population that absolutely refuses to take those medications. How is this education process going to be more effective and or different from what's gone on in the past that has not been efficacious?
You know, that is the trillion-dollar question. It's a very important one. I offer a little bit of hope here, but it's kind of a tragic hope. And that is the fact that oftentimes with childhood immunizations, we don't see the disease immediately. You know, if you're really successful, your success is in the absence of disease, which then nobody knows really how to measure. So if we don't have a measles outbreak, we've done a pretty good job. We are going to be in the middle of this COVID firestorm, and it's going to be bad. And people are going to have lost colleagues, friends, and most of all, loved ones. Hopefully, that when these vaccines become available, there's enough sense that this is real, this is now, this is dangerous, that the people who during childhood immunization anti-vaccine work will at least realize that we've got a crisis right now. Now, I'm not sure that's going to happen. And it may be very well that we're going to have a very hard time getting people vaccinated. As you know, over 50% of the U.S. population in surveys have said they're very concerned about the safety of these vaccines, which could really influence whether they use them or not. We know that, for example, in the Black, Indigenous, and community of color populations, that there's a high level of distrust for this kind of vaccine. And, you know, unfortunately, the name, even Operation Warp Speed, was not a good name in terms of instilling confidence that somehow everything is being done to evaluate safety, which it is. But so I think that our job is really going to be a challenge. But as you know, failure is not an option here in terms of trying to prevent people from dying. So hopefully people will see the seriousness of this pandemic and more people will be willing to take the vaccine.
I want to go back to what people really need to do right now. It strikes me that shutting down restaurants and bars at 10 p.m. is one step, but dear God, what happens between 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. with all these people crowded into these various places? Is doing that enough in these highly populated cities?
You know, if I could take what you just said and put it on a public service announcement on every TV in this country, every hour in the hour, I wish I could, because you said it so well. You know, we're all trying to reduce the risk of this transmission. Everybody's making compromises because we have those who say, don't touch my life. I'm not going to want you to close down anything. You're wrong. You know, it's the ones that I mentioned, the hospitality industry in one state that's trying to get the governor fired. So how do we compromise? How do we get there? From a public health perspective, bars and restaurants are a major source of transmission. As long as they're open, we are going to see transmission. So whether it's before 10 or after 10, that's a compromise. Now, I would rather close them and then pay them and make sure that they're held whole, you know, so that nobody is losing money, so that we all can say, you know what, until we get this pandemic under control, you won't suffer. But at the same time, you're doing a public service because we won't transmit virus there either.
But you have a Congress, a congressional leadership saying we can't just keep handing out money.
You know, this is where that old line is, you can pay me now or pay me later. You know, in my work with the Federal Reserve Bank, and Neel Kashkari, the president here in Minneapolis, has been really a wonderful mentoring experience for me on the economics. I'm not an expert in the economics, but I've learned enough to know. You know, sometimes you have to make an investment to actually make money. In this case, they have looked at this and said, you know, our economy is going to suffer so much in the next 12 to 14 weeks, by doing this at paying back money at such a low interest rate, that this is a really wise investment in our society. It's a wise investment in driving down cases. It's a wise investment in keeping small and medium-sized businesses from going under. It's a wise investment, and people have still been able to pay their rent. So now the landlord isn't being held back either. It's now the ability to buy the groceries so the grocery stores can keep delivering groceries. That's what we need to do right now. So I hope that wiser heads prevail, that we can, instead of having, as I said before, be a blue state or a red state answer, it's a COVID color answer, where we're going to take us as humans versus the virus, not us versus us.
We've seen some countries in Europe take very strong measures, including lockdowns, and now they're having to do so again. Is that the same thing that could happen here?
Well, I think it could happen here. I don't know if the leadership is willing to do that. And I think that's where, I don't think the situation is severe enough yet for people to really understand the true magnitude of what's going to happen. And I think
it's
there will
gotta be. It's got to get worse.
It's got to get worse. In fact, a very famous historian and I today were on a program. He, an expert of the 1918 pandemic, John Barry, who you know. And John and I were having this discussion, and he said it's going to have to get a lot worse, but then people will finally wake up and realize what we're up against.
Wow, that's quite a forecast. Overall, what role do you believe the federal government must play in this pandemic?
We are struggling right now because we have 50 governors all trying to do what we should have from one single leader, and that is to provide the vision, the support, both legally and economic, as well as the sense of hope. And we need a national sense of that right now. So what I hope Washington can do is provide the kinds of resources and policy leadership that we surely need right now. It would help if all the states could be standardized. But at the end, we need somebody to lead us.
What would you urge President-elect Biden to do right now to provide that leadership?
Well, one, I'd have him do an interview with you. Okay, that's first. And then I'd play that everywhere. The second of all is I just think he is the right person to give us those fireside chats. He is the wise person that we need right now that's compassionate. I mean, have you known a politician in your life who's more compassionate than this man? You know, he's that. And so that's what this country needs right now, is somebody to say, we're going to come together on this. I don't care if you voted for me or not. I want, and he said that. So I think that's the role he can play right now, is bring us together. And then let's have a plan. If I could tell you, this is a short, limited time period that we're going to be doing this. And this is why. Because if I can get us to the other side of this virus river, we're in, you know, the right place. We're going to be in the Holy Land. That's where the vaccines are at. And then we can get protected, not from having to experience the virus and maybe getting seriously ill and dying, but we have the vaccines. So that's what we're trying to get people to do.
So what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
My partner and I are going to spend it alone. We're going to do virtual Thanksgiving. We're going to be making some food and delivering it to people who don't have someone in their lives. We're going to leave it on their front porch, you know, ring the doorbell, let them come to the door. We'll be 20 feet away. We will send them our love. And you know what else I'm going to do this year? I'm going to call all the people in the world that I should call and tell them, thank you for being born, for being in my life. I'm going to make this a celebration and say, you know, this year I'm not so busy that I can't do that. I'm going to call you and say, oh my, I'm so glad you were born. Thank you.
Are you using air purification in your dwelling?
I'm not. My partner and I are, you know, basically sequestered. We're being very, very careful ourselves. We're bubbled, and it's been hard. I've got five of the most beautiful, wonderful grandchildren between the ages of 10 and 3. My two kids live nearby here. I miss them so much, Diane. Oh my gosh, I miss them. So, you know, I get it. And occasionally we do get together in parks where we're more than 20 feet apart, but it's hard with the young ones. They don't understand that. They want to run to grandpa, you know, and they want to wrestle. They don't get the fact that, no, we got to stay 20 feet apart. But for Thanksgiving this year, we're going to do a virtual one. And I'm just going to be so thankful for all the good things I have.
Do you think that the same is going to be true for Christmas?
I do think so. We're not even going to be close to getting out of this at Christmas time. You know what I've done in my podcast each week? I've tried to help give people a sense of the future in a way of saying also feel empowered. This is your COVID year. It's not like last year. It's not going to be like next year, hopefully with the vaccine. And if you really love your family, you'll say, I'm not going to expose my family to a virus because one of my kids or me, not knowing I'm infected, may bring it into that household. Diane, I have been involved with too many situations just recently where some young adult or even a grandchild brought the virus into a home setting with a celebration, not realizing that there was transmission. And 3 weeks later, Grandpa and Grandma, Uncle Bill and Aunt Jane, one of them are dead. Do you know the pain and tragedy of that happening? And so my ultimate love this year is to actually love someone so much, I'm not going to give you a virus, but I'm going to make sure next year we're going to have one heck of a Thanksgiving party. Oh my, is that going to be beautiful.
And that's a perfect way to end this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Dr. Michael Osterholm. He is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Please